A fourth case, Williams versus Koenig, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stephen Anderson on behalf of the appellant, Mark Whitman. This case involves the interpretation of exemption statutes in the state of Wisconsin, and specifically Section 815.18, 3J, and 3F. The bankruptcy court allowed the debtors in this case to receive a full exemption for funds they had put into the purchase of annuities less than 24 months before filing bankruptcy. It is that decision and some prior bankruptcy court decisions doing the same thing in past years that is the subject of this appeal. It's important to note that exemptions in the state of Wisconsin do not come from the common law. Instead, they are statutorily created. And although the statute which creates them says that the debtor should receive the full benefit of that exemption, nothing in the statute allows furtherance of what the legislature has put in place for the scheme of exemptions.
What does that mean?
I believe what it means is that this is not a situation where anything a debtor does
should be allowed as an exemption.
No, of course not.
Nobody's suggesting that. Yeah. But the language of 3J, is it your contention that that's unambiguous in your favor?
Yes.
Really?
I think it's very close to ambiguous, but I think the language which states the provisions of the Internal Code or Internal Revenue Code, rather than any provision, singular or a provision,
what are you talking about? It says complies with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code.
Yes.
You're trying to rewrite it or what?
No, I'm not. I believe that it is the provisions, meaning provisions applicable to the type of product.
Which ones? All of them?
Look,
I'll just tell you, you've got a steep hill to climb, at least with me, in trying to suggest that this is unambiguous.
Okay.
And we do have the instruction in subsection 1 to construe this to secure its full benefit to debtors, advance the humane purpose of preserving the debtors and their dependents, the means of obtaining a livelihood. The legislature has told us what to do with ambiguities here, right?
They have told us to construe it in favor of the debtor, but they have not said create an exemption where the legislature didn't put one in place. And I think that's the position. And I agree it's a difficult question as to whether it's ambiguous, but if we're
but
talking...
But now, what are the provisions you think this J2A is referring to?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Which provision? It says plan or contract complies with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. So what provisions do you think are pertinent?
Well, the overall section of J is payable under any retirement, and it goes through and lists a number of things. Generally, the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code relevant to all of those items are sections 401 through 409.
Are those the only ones that are relevant?
There may be others.
There are.
I'm sure there are others.
There's 72, there's 457, there's a whole bunch of different things, right?
Yes.
So how do we know what the legislature's talking about here?
The fact that, and if we go to your comment about whether this is ambiguous, if we look at ambiguity, we can then look at other extrinsic evidence, including the title. It says retirement benefits.
Okay,
it says retirement or similar plan or contract providing benefits by reason of age, illness, disability, death, or length of service, etc., right? So
yes.
That's not just retirement funds by its own terms.
We believe that most of them are related to
retirement
or employment.
Most, yes. That's true.
But we can also look to the overall scheme created with that and 3F. There's very little left for 3F to cover when the term annuities was added to 3F.
Okay. Is there anything for 3F to cover, in your view?
I'm not aware of any. I've looked at the examples given by the appellee, and quite honestly, there wasn't enough information in there for me to determine, such as who owns the annuity or other information. The Christofferson case they mentioned was not an annuity. That was a contract which would allow them to convert certain funds into an annuity in the future.
Are there annuities that do not comply with Section 72 of the Internal Revenue Code?
I'm not aware of any. I can't think of any.
Well, is your notion that this provision is about retirement annuities, broadly understood, but, you know, something, money accumulates for some when you're old or sick or something, not able to work anymore. That seems to be the general character of the various types of investment listed in J1. Is that your position?
I believe that
is retirement benefits in a broad sense.
Yes, and I think how you then narrow it is with the provisions of J2A and B, which say, all right, here is the broad spectrum, but they need to either be employer-related or employment-related, which would be consistent with something that is generally used or intended for retirement, or they need to comply with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. And we believe that is also, you know, what are the provisions which would look at something that is a retirement-type product, and that would be 401 through 409, which would allow for debtor-owned annuities. I think further evidence of that and the legislative intent in that is the note of the Legislative Reference Bureau when this was amended in 2004, where they said, Under current law, debtor-owned annuities aren't exempt. So they certainly, appellee has argued that by not explicitly overturning Bogue and other cases, the legislator was implicitly upholding those decisions. I don't think that says that at all. What we believe the legislature was saying is, or showing, is either we don't agree with those prior cases, we don't think debtor-owned annuities are included in 3J, or they simply weren't even aware of those prior cases.
And how, I think, how would legislators and legislative staff working on this exemption do that in some kind of vacuum where they're not paying attention to the federal bankruptcy court decisions within the state? I mean, isn't that really the front line for this particular area of state law?
Yes, and it would surprise me if they weren't aware. So I think actually the first interpretation may be more likely, which is we don't agree with that.
Well,
we
if they don't agree with law, them, then can't why shouldn't they have just said there are cases, bankruptcy judges are getting this wrong, or we think we have a different policy, we need to approach this. This just looks like it's an oversight.
I don't think it's an oversight. I think they were saying, you know, they didn't say it explicitly. Maybe this was, you know, who knows? Maybe it was drafting by a committee or something like that. Sometimes what should be said isn't said, but they do state that under current law, debtor-owned annuities are not covered, are not exempt.
What's the difference between a debtor-owned annuity and a retirement annuity?
Well, a retirement annuity will generally be something related to the employer where they put it in place, or if
a lot of people are self-employed, or, you know, maybe investing independently.
And I agree, 401 through 409 covers those situations where a self-employed person can put in place a retirement annuity or something that complies with those sections. these annuities do not comply with those provisions. They do not comply with 401 through 409.
And they don't? For what reason?
I asked you, what
are these debtor annuities? Can you just explain it? Words of one syllable. What's a debtor annuity?
The debtor-owned annuity? These annuities, quite honestly, from what I can see of them, are similar to something a 25-year-old could purchase for payments starting at 35.
Just explain what it is, will you please?
Sure. They paid a premium, and...
Well, look, start off. Okay, I want to buy a debtor-owned annuity. Now, what do I do?
You contact an insurance company or some other entity that offers up investment services, and you purchase a debtor-owned annuity.
Okay, what do they tell me? I say, I've heard of something called a debtor-owned annuity. Now, would you tell me what that is so I can decide whether I want to buy?
Sure. It's an annuity that I am going to own in my
own name.
Well,
you haven't told me what an annuity is, all right? Just explain it to a dope, right?
All right. An annuity is something you purchase now and receive set payments on a regular basis in the future, and under Chapter 72, taxation of any gain or benefit in that is deferred until you actually get back the money.
Until you get back what?
The money that you have contracted to receive back.
So I don't understand. So I buy this thing, and it pays me in the future.
Yes.
And when I receive those payments, are they taxable?
The gain is, yes.
The gain?
Yeah, any gain on that, because I've purchased them with post-tax dollars, so I don't have to pay tax.
No, wait a second.
This is why Section 72 is so long and complicated, right?
I'm lost now, okay? I buy this annuity $10,000. I spent $10,000 the insurance company, and I'm going to be getting some specified annual repayments, okay? Now, when do I start paying tax?
Once I receive a payment back from the annuity company and I pay tax.
Okay, every year, and that's not paying the tax. Is that the whole deal? That's what a debtor-owned annuity is? That's all it is?
For purposes of this case, I believe
and
that's
so
the
your
relevant
proposition
topics.
Is this is not the type of annuity contemplated by J2A or J2B.
Yes.
That's your argument.
Yes.
Could I just ask quickly, the trustee has not attempted to show in this case that the debtors were insolvent or became insolvent by making these purchases, right?
By their filing of bankruptcy, I believe.
At the time of the purchases, right?
No, we have not. Okay. Everything in the record was...
That's the protection against fraudulent conveyance, right? That protects other creditors, right?
Yes.
But there's been no attempt to make that showing here.
We have not made that attempt.
And I'm talking there just about constructive fraud, right?
Yes.
Okay. Not tried to show that, and no attempt to show intentional placement of assets for fraudulent purposes beyond the reach of creditors.
We have not made an attempt under Section 10, no.
Why are those provisions not sufficient protection for your purposes?
We have the underlying bankruptcy court cases at this point, which have never come up on appeal, which are saying that it is proper and appropriate for you to take non-exempt funds that would normally be available and simply purchase this investment vehicle, the annuity. And the trustee decided it's a very difficult standard to try to overturn based on fraudulent conduct or other conduct what has already been recognized as the right of a debtor to plan using law concerning exemptions. It's a very difficult standard. And here, the interpretation of Part J and the interrelationship of Parts J and F have never come before this court or any other appellate court.
Well, is your argument simply that there's nothing special about these debtor-owned annuities that would entitle them to escape bankruptcy? Is that your argument?
Yes. They're not a retirement-type product anticipated by Part J. And instead, what they are is a vehicle.
So you're saying the only possible way of getting them out of the bankruptcy, letting the bankrupt keep them, would be if it fit J, say.
No, Part F contains within it an exemption if they're purchased more than 2 years.
Right. I understand. Okay, so if it doesn't fall under an exemption, if it doesn't fall within one of these two exemptions, you can't see any basis on which it's treated differently from any other asset of the bankrupt. Is that what you're saying? That's your position?
I'm not sure how an annuity wouldn't fall within either J or F. What we are saying is
that... Well, no, they're the annuities that are debtor-owned, right? You don't recognize them as... As a J.
Not as J. We feel they come under F, where, and that's where it talks about debtor-owned, unmatured debtor-owned annuities.
Right,
come
but
under
your
F.
Point is that the debtor-owned annuities are like any other investment. There's nothing special about them, unless they come under J. Isn't that what you're saying? Well, then they're not the debtor-owned.
Yes.
But that's your whole argument.
Yes, I think it's a statutory scheme created by J&F where non-retirement, non-employment, non-401 through 409 annuities come under F, are given an exemption, but it's limited if it's done within 24 months of filing bankruptcy. Retirement or employment-themed annuities that comply with 401 through 409 or other applicable provisions are entitled to full exemption under Part J.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Stevenson?
May it please the Court. My name is Craig Stevenson, and I represent Timothy and Jill Koenig, the debtors and appellees in this matter. As noted, the Koenigs claim their annuity is exempt under 815.18.3J of the Wisconsin statutes, and that statute has a requirement that the annuities comply with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code in order to be exempt. What it means to comply with the Internal Revenue Code's provisions is a legal question that is not clearly answered by the text of the statute. But the legislative history of Sub J provides an answer to that question. It protects non-qualified retirement accounts, such as those owned by the Koenigs. And every Wisconsin bankruptcy court to address this issue has ruled that way. That complies with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, reaches all annuities that comply with Section 72 of the Internal Revenue Code, also known as non-qualified annuities, such as those owned by the Koenigs.
Well, what do you do with J?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What do you do with J?
So J protects annuities that pay benefits by certain reasons enumerated in that statute.
Right.
That's one requirement. And the second requirement is that they're either employer-created or employer-sponsored, or if they're not that, they must comply with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. So annuities is defined very broadly under the Wisconsin statutes. It simply means that it's any series of payments payable over the life of the annuitant or over a specific period. That definition is in 815.18.2 AM. And that definition reaches a broad set of annuities. 815.18.3J narrows that.
The annuities involved in this case, you think they're within J?
Yes, Your Honor, because they comply with all the requirements of Sub J. They pay benefits for the right reasons, and that is stipulated in this matter. The only issue that's at issue here is whether they comply with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, and we're simply interpreting that the way every Wisconsin bankruptcy court has interpreted that, that they comply with Section 72. And the fact that they comply with Section 72 is also stipulated in this case. So there's no disagreement as to that they pay benefits for the right reasons, according to Jay, and there's no disagreement that they are they comply with the provisions of Section 72.
Is there any dollar limit to this J exemption?
The legislature did not put a dollar limit in sub J.
Okay. And are there any annuities that, I don't know, on the market or even conceptually that don't comply with Section 72?
Well, that don't comply with Section 72, I think the answer to that is I know that Section 72S has particular requirements regarding the payment of death benefits following the death of the annuitant. They must be paid at least as quickly as they were to be paid prior to the annuitant's death, or they must be distributed within 5 years. So if an annuity contract did not have those features, that the death benefit is paid out in accordance with Section 72, then the annuity would not comply.
So in essence, if you're careful enough in drafting the plan, you ought to be able to comply with 72, right?
Correct. And certainly large insurance companies, financial institutions, hire teams of accountants and lawyers to ensure compliance.
Yeah. So let me ask, what do you think the 2004 amendment to Section 3F actually did? What's your theory?
Well, it did two things. First of all, at the same time that amendment was enacted, the legislature for the first time defined annuities. And as I said, it was defined very broadly to include any series of payments payable over the life of the annuitant or over a specific period. So it started there by broadly defining annuities. And then it said, we're also going to include an exemption for annuities in sub F. So it creates any annuity that isn't included in sub J. So those would be annuities that don't pay benefits for one of the right reasons, or an annuity that doesn't comply with Section 72, but is one of these plans or contracts that, you know, pays a series of payments.
If somebody who's 30 years old buys an annuity that starts paying immediately, would that qualify under J, monthly payments immediately?
It may. If the death benefit complied with the Section 72 provision that I articulated, it would comply with the Internal Revenue Code. And it would also have to pay benefits for the right reasons.
But that's my question, because it wouldn't be paying by reason of age, illness. It would just be a monthly income.
Correct. So if somebody wanted to have a steady stream of monthly income at a point in their life that didn't have anything to do with retirement, presumably
kind of like a spendthrift trust, that is, we're going to protect. You want to protect yourself from yourself.
Correct, Your Honor. And that would not fall under J, because it doesn't pay benefits for the right reasons. So even if it is tax compliant, it misses the other requirement of sub J, but it would fall under sub F. And so the trustee in this matter is concerned about there being redundancy or superfluity with respect to sub F, and the example highlights that there isn't, that sub F does do some work with respect to particular annuities. I also wanted to talk for a moment about the liberal construction of Wisconsin exemption statutes. That was something that was very important to the bankruptcy court in upholding the exemptions that the Koenigs claimed in their annuities. It said, sustaining the trustee's objection requires narrowly construing this exemption statute, despite the fact that the liberal construction is the prevailing interpretation. It's the prevailing interpretation because, according to Wisconsin law, exemptions are to be construed broadly or liberally in favor of the debtor. And what that means is where an exemption statute may be interpreted either favorably or unfavorably vis-a-vis the interests of the debtor, the court must interpret the statute in a manner that favors the debtor. So any ambiguity that's present in the language of the statute, if there is more than one interpretation...
Maybe I asked you this before, but is there any annuity that is not exempt? Any annuity contract that is not exempt?
Every annuity would be exempt under either J or F. J is unlimited. F is limited. It is limited by dollar amount in two phases.
And by
time. Yes, and by time. So if the debtor has invested in a sub-F annuity within 2 years prior to claiming the exemption, the dollar limit is $4,000. If the annuity was invested in more than 2 years prior to claiming the exemption, then the dollar limit is capped at $150,000. So if you're in J, there's no dollar cap, there's no time limit looked
at. So are all annuities in either F or J?
All annuities are either in F or J. To the extent that annuity is broadly defined under the Wisconsin statutes, yes.
So what do you make of this bill analysis from the proposal that became the 2004 amendments? current law does not address exemptions from creditor claims for an unmatured annuity that is owned by the debtor, etc.
It must be an error or misstatement of the law. And we know that because the amendment to sub F refers to sub J. So it's implausible that the legislature, in enacting an amendment to F to add annuities to that subsection, and then referring, saying, except as already provided in sub J. Well, sub F only covers life insurance and annuities. Sub J doesn't cover life insurance. So the reference to sub J shows that they knew that there was another law that dealt with annuity exemptions.
Is there substantial Wisconsin state court precedent dealing with these statutes? Or is this all litigated in the federal bankruptcy courts?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor. There are three cases where this issue came directly on point. I mean, this is
in the bankruptcy courts.
In the bankruptcy courts, correct. And it has come up only in the context of exemption being claimed in bankruptcy. And this exact argument has been made and rejected three times, now four, including the court below. I also wanted to talk for a moment about the language of the statute, because I think that's very important in construing the statute. The phrase compliance with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, it isn't clear exactly what that means, but what is clear is that there are some terms or some language that is missing from that, and I think that highlights that the exemption was intended by the legislature to be construed broadly. As noted, the trustee wants to read this compliance with the provisions of the Internal Revenue language narrowly to require compliance with sections 401 through 409. But that begs the question, if that was the intent of the legislature, why did they not name those specific sections in the exemption statute? There are several examples of other statutes on the Wisconsin books that reference the specific sections, Internal Revenue Code sections 401 through 409. That would have been a simple matter either in enacting the statute in 1990 or when the exemption statutes were revised in 2004 to add this language to clear up what provisions they were talking about. But that wasn't done, and I think that's telling with respect to the legislature's intent in having this be broadly construed. And I'll conclude then by saying, for the reasons I've stated today and for all the reasons set forth in my brief, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the bankruptcy court and uphold the Koenigs' exemptions in their annuities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Mr. Anderson, you have anything further?
Briefly, Your Honor. I want to go back to the 2004 amendment.
I'm a little confused now about what the disagreement is. So the annuities involved in this case, the debtor-owned annuities, these, would you agree they provide some tax benefits under F? Are they F annuities?
We believe they're F annuities.
So
yes.
They get some benefits.
There is a deferral of the payment of tax. So instead of paying tax immediately as there's any
type
of a gain.
Okay, so you acknowledge their F entitlement. You just say they don't belong under J.
Yes, and I think going back to the amendment in 2004, this type of annuity, which is it's owned by the debtors, they purchased it on their own. It's not employer related. It doesn't comply with 401 through 409. And when the legislature put in place the amendment in 2004, certainly they were aware of J. They were aware of their statute, and they said that doesn't apply to this type of annuity.
The argument basically that sympathy for retirees or something of that sort, or belief that annuities for retirement are important, is important for people to make provision for their retirement, made the legislature want retirement-related annuities to be given substantially greater benefits than other types of annuities?
I think that's generally correct. I don't think it's sympathy for, because that gets into what I would call a subjective intent. You know, I put away $10 at age 20, I can tell anybody it's for retirement. 401 through 409 are far more objective, and they're looking at providing a full exemption for those type of annuities which comply with those, with the applicable provisions of the Internal Revenue Code.
Retirement plans covered by 401 through 409, they're typically dollar limits on the tax-protected or deferred contributions, correct?
Many of them are, yes.
Yeah, okay. And then, and that's not applicable here under 72, right? But isn't it true that, that under these debtors' annuities, there's a penalty if they get paid before they're 59 and a half?
Only if it's an early withdrawal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that frankly, that kind of feels to me like a retirement savings sort of arrangement, even if it doesn't use 401 through 409.
And I would disagree on the interpretation of that. I think it's more, all right, we'll give somebody over 59 and a half a bonus on that if they decide to, you know, they've entered into a contract.
No, we won't penalize them.
We won't penalize them to 10%. But if a 25-year-old buys an annuity and it's to start paying when they're age 35, they don't pay any penalty if they start to take those payments and the gain at 35 because it's not an early withdrawal. Hmm. So it's more a benefit to a 59-and-a-half-year-old.
Okay. Thank you.
So if they are in the contract, they can benefit by being of that age.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you.